From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. American schools have for years suffered many challenges, often born of unequal or inadequate funding, existing within a deeply stratified socioeconomic landscape, hampered by the demands for standardized testing, and threatened by the presence of law enforcement. Now a new book explores what its author calls educational trauma. Psychologist Dr. Leanne Gray writes in her new book that the current state of educational affairs are, quote, the way schools are places where students feel shame, unsafe, unable to manage stress, and at worst medicated, abused, and sent to prison. The state of educational affairs is one that creates trauma and then looks away. Dr. Gray is also an educator, author, and national speaker. She served as forensic and clinical consulting psychologist to public defenders, families, students, and school districts throughout the state of California. She was an instructor of psychology of gender in the departments of psychology and women's studies at UCLA. And her book is called Educational Trauma, Examples from Testing to the School-to-Prison Pipeline. Welcome to the program, Dr. Gray.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. Appreciate it.
So, of course, the way we talk about schools these days during the pandemic might have changed somewhat, but in general, how do you define this term educational trauma? We don't usually necessarily think of schools as places where trauma is generated.
Indeed. The intention of schools as a common good is to raise up children with skills that can be utilized for their health, well-being, success, and achievement later in life. Unfortunately, I recognized around 2010 that schools were implementing practices that weren't, in fact, benefiting the students. And so I define educational trauma as the unintentional and inadvertent harm perpetrated and perpetuated in schools. And ultimately, the people affected include students, educators, staff, administrators, parents, and communities as well.
So let's talk about the examples that you cite in your book to illustrate the fact that there is this trauma. And I think it's important, of course, the word inadvertent, because most people don't want schools to be places where children are traumatized. What are some of the case studies that you cite in your book to show that, in fact, children do end up traumatized in school?
So students are inadvertently traumatized in school with a number of case examples. So the ones that I highlighted in my book are particularly severe. And so the first one was about a boy, Jesus, around 11 years old. He had been diagnosed with autism and was the one of several children being raised by a parent. Jesus, in his diagnosis of autism, received a good number of supports, services, thankful to the advocacy of his mother. One of the treatments for autism is applied behavioral analysis, and it's a way of using behavioral techniques to minimize or eliminate behaviorals that are inappropriate or not effective for a person. What I found when I met Jesus in his school quite some time ago was that the applied behavioral analysis techniques that were aimed at reducing his self-stimulating, self-soothing behaviors that are common in autism were actually directly addressing petit mal seizures. And I quickly flashed back to his history of 14 months old when in the care of a daycare, a large bookcase had fallen on his head, causing a traumatic brain injury. This is an example, a very severe example, of how a student in great need received extensive services, and while well-intended, they missed the point. There are a lot more complexities to this, but this is certainly one example.
What are the ways in which standardized testing contributes to trauma? I mean, this is a practice that has been widely criticized by many educators as themselves, by activists, and even by parents. But how can standardized testing create trauma in students?
Yeah, let's first look at where it came from before we start to criticize it. Standardized testing, standardized curriculum and testing were implemented on very, very wide scale with the intention of rising the academic caliber of students age 15 in the global competitive marketplace. The upside of this is that data science, data analytics, observation, quantifiable measures, these were things that humanity had begun to truly value because it was representing and demonstrating to people things that they previously couldn't see but now had proof existed. It seemed like a good idea to apply that to education, and here we are 20 years later, and it's actually been a huge mistake. Because learning and going to school and growing up and teaching and being a professional educator is not the same as a science experiment, nor is it how we figure out in a capitalist society if goods and services are worth perpetuating. So as a result, testing has been well intended in its application, but the net result has been damaging. The damages are in the area of anxiety, the anxiety caused to all people who encounter schools around testing is very, very high. The pressure, the perfectionism complex that is being passed around from admin to educators to students, from parents to students, it's widespread. And so testing that causes anxiety and pressure and perfectionism is fairly mild. On the most severe end, students are literally committing suicide for failing one math test.
Well, how do you respond to those defenders of testing who say, well, school is there to prepare kids for the real world. If they can't handle the pressures of taking a test, then et cetera, et cetera. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, there are certainly real world pressures, but other than the licensing exam I took many years ago, I'm not regularly tested to the extent that we test students. So applying pressure on students in the form of testing is abusive. It's not preparation for grit and resilience. There are alternative methods of assessment that are called qualitative methods, and they can reveal the same information about whether or not students and educational programs are successful or not.
Homework is also something that can lead to educational trauma, right? I mean, there are certainly, I think there's more research these days about whether homework is really of enough value to you know, justify burdening children after they've already spent a full day at work, you know, working in a school environment, working to learn, taking work home. Again, you see these sorts of justifications by proponents of homeworks that it prepares kids for the real world. But what sort of educational trauma stems from something as simple as homework?
Right. Homework is an example of educational trauma because the educational system essentially tells students and families that time after school is not their own, that it is still controlled by schools and the demands they place. Homework prevents students from recharging, from resting, from having recreation. It prevents them from moving their bodies, from playing, from getting involved with other people of all ages and socializing. It prevents them from having opportunities for hobbies and sports. And meanwhile, some parents, not in all communities, are implementing a high degree of structure to offer those types of activities in addition to school, because many of them are not included in school, in which case, after a full day of school, students are expected to do extracurricular activities and still find time for homework. And I can't imagine too many adults settling for that as a way of life, and yet many parents and educators will impose that on students, saying it's for their own good when in fact it is doing much harm.
And then, of course, you have the criminalization of kids, particularly in poor school districts. I mentioned police in schools. It's so interesting to see members of Congress resist having to walk through a metal detector on the Capitol, whereas so many public school kids around the country routinely have to deal with walking through metal detectors. They see cops in the hallways. And of course, the prison testing, the prison school to prison pipeline, which is in the title of your book, is also one that has been studied. But how do you link what happens in the school environment? What is your analysis of how that school to prison pipeline gets generated? And of course, it's a given that such a thing is deeply traumatic.
Right. In 1999, the Columbine shooting increased national concerns for safety in schools. And there were many ways that we implemented different safety measures. And one of them was on-campus school resource officers, which is a euphemistic term for police officers on campus. As a result of having criminal justice professionals on campus, there was a replication of the level of racial oppression, discrimination, and oppression that we see through police brutality on school campuses. So we see that LGBTQ youth and students of color are more likely to experience interactions with criminal justice. They receive infractions, citations for truancy, for same gender affection, things that students that are part of the dominant culture, that are cisgender, heterosexual appearing, would never, ever, ever have that happen. And as a result, according to Rios, we know that 100% of brown and black male students experience criminal justice in schools for the first time.
100%? So they're not,
100% out of Rios's research reveal that all of those boys experience police officers and infractions with criminal justice on school. That shows us that racism, oppression, and police brutality starts in school, and that's where that school-to-prison pipeline is a direct pathway into the prison-industrial complex, thereby sustaining white supremacy.
So what, as a psychologist, how do, especially boys of color, what is the impact on their mental health when this happens? And of course, black and brown parents, I'm sure, face this question on a daily basis when they send their kids to school, and the fears I cannot even imagine. But in terms of how, you know, a child's brain, which is not fully developed, which is developing, what is the trauma? What is the impact of that trauma of being criminalized on a school campus like?
So Rios's study book talks a lot about boys and male students of color, as you're bringing it up. But I want to just remember that female students of color experience incredible violence, rape, and other forms of discrimination, oppression, and abuse as well. Back to your point about boys, according to Rios, they are relegated to this secondary universe, this alternate society where they are ensured social death. And by social death, Rios describes it as the inability to get a job, the inability to vote, the inability to find shelter. And when you take away that any kind of access to those basic needs, we essentially ensure not only social death, but imminent death.
So you mentioned earlier LGBTQ youth in particular. What do young people, especially those who, you know, experience the intersection of multiple oppressions, you know, black and brown LGBTQ youth, do they face also even more serious traumas?
Yes, thank you very much for mentioning the work of Kimberly Williams Crenshaw. She's my most original theoretician on the ideas of intersectionality. And what her work notes is that the more social, cultural, biological identities that layer on top of a person, the more likely they are to experience discrimination, oppression, marginalization. There's so much more to it, but that's a very basic overlying thing. So you're paying attention to the fact that in schools, students have multiple intersectional identities, being sexual orientation, gender identity, race, religion, ethnicity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ultimately, the more of these identities that intersect in a person, the more likely they are to experience different forms of educational trauma.
So we, you know, of course, schools, parents, school districts acknowledge that children experience trauma in school, even if they may not necessarily always acknowledge the sources of the trauma. There are school counselors. Most public school districts have school counselors. Do you tackle how counselors can help address the trauma, whether it's even enough to have school counselors or whether schools in general hire and keep enough counselors on staff?
It's a bit of a complicated question because counselors have their ways of delivering their work, and they perform certain roles and services in schools. The one thing that I can speak to is what are the things that people of any role in schools can do to ameliorate this problem? And at the most basic level, I think that empathy is a first step. And by empathy, I mean stop and listen. We don't have to know what another person's experience is exactly, but the willingness to pause and become curious about it, to learn about it through self-study, and to be on the lookout and listening for people and what they have to say, particularly teachers looking at students and listening to them rather than telling to them. There's also empathy circles that I wrote about in several of my books, and those are definitely skills that I've taught to teachers in professional development, and I've seen students utilize it. That skill, as a bare minimum, is a good first step, but ultimately, I think democratic schools and the inclusion of design thinking practices is where we need to go.
So is there a move toward that you are heartened by toward eliminating homework, eliminating standardized testings? It seems that, you know, you can't even justify that on the basis of safety, right? They justify police and metal detectors saying it's for the kids' physical safety. And of course, we know that it harms kids, but homework and testing, if there's enough research showing that it does more harm than good, are there steps that are being taken? Do you see instances where schools are eliminating it?
Well, in that question, I feel sad just listening to it, because the mandate of testing in schools comes straight from the federal government, and it's a bipartisan decision to base the evaluation of school programs, teachers, etc., on those test scores. And that type of legislation has recently been reauthorized for 50 years. So we're looking at another several decades of overvaluing the role of testing, despite the fact that we have evidence demonstrating how problematic it is.
50 years, it's pretty remarkable. In terms of the long-term impacts on kids, you started out citing the story of the 11-year-old child, Jesus. We talked about intersectionality. What about disability? What sort of traumas do disabled kids who are obviously needing extra support at school and who we know government has mandated require and should get extra support, how do they experience traumas in school?
So for severely disabled students, it typically involves litigation for them to obtain the services they need, which means that parents who are taking care of students with very special needs have to fight in the courts and
typically,
hire lawyers.
So you're saying more often than not, they have to sue school districts? Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
I think it's even worse with kids who have what we call special needs on the learning disordered spectrum. So severe needs are a little bit less litigious, but the ADD, ADHD, we're talking about learning disorders and autism. Those types of special needs tend to bring up a lot of conflict between school districts and parents, especially in California, where I'm most aware. It may differ from state to state, but the schools are very open about denying services to students in need and telling parents that if you want anything more than nothing, please hire a lawyer. And then through that, often the students are served. So that's an extra level of abuse that the educational system layers on top of students, parents, and educators for students with special needs. And by when I say an added level of abuse to educators, they have to spend a lot of time dealing with this, which takes away from the teaching that they're doing to the other students.
You have a whole section on bullying, which is, of course, perhaps the most commonly examined form of school source trauma. There's, you know, before I came to the United States, my sort of impression of the public school system in the U.S. was entirely from movies, and it was terrifying because there's so much depiction of bullying in schools. But it is a real thing. What are the ways? I mean, we know bullying obviously causes trauma. Is that the thing you were referring to earlier, where teachers and counselors and staff, just by listening to kids rather than talking at them, is that a start to tackling the issue of bullying, at least from the adults in the room?
There's a number of different ways to look at how to address bullying. And over the last 10 or 20 years, the programs that have been the most prolific have failed us. So when I wrote my book on educational trauma, the largest chapter, is on bullying, and it's 8,000 words, which is an insane amount for a chapter. And in that, I really tried to show a number of different elements about bullying. First of all, there's the bully, there's the victim, and then there's the bystander. And I believe that all three are negatively impacted. And then I also find that adults tend to feel very impotent, ineffective, helpless, powerless, while being responsible when they see or are experiencing themselves any kind of bullying. So bullying in America, I'm from Canada, from another country as well, but bullying in the United States has a very paralyzing effect on vast numbers of people. And so some of the ways that I address it in my chapter is by, number one, saying, can any of us admit to having been once a bully, a victim of bullying, and a bystander? And in my book, I say, I'll start, and let me do it here as well. With deep regret and sincere apology, I have bullied. I have bullied my students into believing that standardized testing is important for their growth, but I know better, and I deeply regret that I ever bullied them. And so that is one way that one can be vulnerable and take responsibility, and I call this trauma accountability, and that to me is one of the second starts after empathy.
Well, I want to thank you on that note for spending this time with us. Of course, so much more to talk about. Our audience can check out your book themselves to get the full picture. Good luck to you with the book, and thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it, and appreciate the work you do as well. Be well.
My guest has been Dr. Leanne Gray. She's a psychologist, educator, author, and national speaker. She served as forensic and clinical consulting psychologist to public defenders, families, students, and school districts throughout California. She was an instructor of psychology of gender in the departments of psychology and women's studies at UCLA. And we've been discussing her new book, Educational Trauma, Examples from Testing to the School-to-Prison Pipeline. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.